If you are a startup looking to grow in Cambridge, the Bradfield Centre offers a range of flexible membership packages which put you in control of your office and home working mix. There's a vibrant, collaborative atmosphere, on-site cafe, plenty of green outside space, and regular member social events. For more information, visit bradfieldcentre.com or call 01223 919 600.
Welcome to the Cambridge Tech Podcast, talking all things technology from the heart of the UK's tech capital. Here are your hosts, Faye Holland and James Parton.
Hi, I'm Faye.
And I'm James. So this week is a short one. We've only got 4 days this week. What have you crammed in this week, Faye, in the shortened week?
So I went over to Ideaspace and met with quite a few of the founders from the University of Cambridge program, which was really super interesting. And then also another couple, one on medtech, one on health tech. Really exciting. I don't know what's happened in Cambridge, but it is so buoyant at the moment with people wanting to do things, which is just great news. I started the week with a board meeting for the Cambridgeshire Chamber of Commerce. On Wednesday, I went to Would I Sigh to You, which is the Cambridge Science Centre event, which will be next week's episode. And I did fit a bit of work in as well, I think. From what I remember. So what about you? Match that.
Well, yeah, I've been a complete slacker compared to you. This week I went to Brighton to a gig with my son. So, yeah, I haven't actually done very much. But I caught up with Adelina Chalmers, who many people will know locally, and Vicky Barcroft was back in town, back from Manchester. So
very good. And were they both well?
Yeah, really good, yeah.
Do you remember when the four of us did a podcast when this was the Inside the Bradfield podcast and we did it on events during lockdown, didn't we?
That's right. Yes, there is a podcast link there. Well done. I actually forgot that, but I do remember that, yeah.
Fond memories, trying to work out what on earth we're all going to do when we're all locked up in our homes, but there we go. Right, let's talk the news this week, and there's a few pieces of news and updates for you again. So we'll start with quantum. There is a Cambridge Canada collaboration underway in the field of quantum computers where New Quantum, who many of you will know is a Cambridge University spin-out, and a sector innovator company called Software Q in Ontario, they are advancing a program sponsored by the governments of both countries. They're collaborating on a project to build the theoretical framework for the first fault-tolerant quantum computer. So New Quantum, who's led by Dr. Carmen Palacio-Berraquero, and Software Q Inc. is co-founded by Dr. Vlad Gheorghiu and Professor Michelle Mosca, will propose and benchmark practical architectural solutions to address the challenge of scaling.
QPT, who are a Cambridge-based GaN electric motor control company, have raised more than $1 million in a CrowdCube funding round. It passed the milestone this week, just 3 days ahead of the round closing, and the funds will be used to scale up production and headcount, plus a global filing of 12 patents to further protect its technology. Did you also see this week, we're talking about CrowdCube, Just Park just had a merger kind of with a US parking provider. So there's a big payout for lots of CrowdCube investors there, which is exciting.
Yeah, and you know, the whole crowdsourcing for tech companies is definitely on the up. I think we talked about one even just a couple of weeks ago, and I know Veena Aditya, she's just crowdsourced 200K to help her company SmartBell move to the next level. So it's great news for them, and it's just a different funding source, isn't it?
Yeah, it just gives founders more options, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Other news, Pragmatic Semiconductor has hired 100 people over the past year and is now looking to add another 140 team members in the near future across Cambridge and the northeast of England. CEO David Moore told Business Weekly, "We believe we will need 500 additional hires in the UK over the next 5 years as we scale our capacity to tens of billions of chips per year and beyond."
Andrew Gower, who's the co-inventor of the world-famous video game RuneScape, has launched Brighter Shores, which is potentially a blockbuster for the games industry. Andrew's going to be the CEO of the company and lead designer, and has invested more than $5 million of his own money making the game and the FenForge engine that runs it. There are also plans to make the FenForge game engine available so other developers can also use it to make their own games.
Really excited. And we have asked for an intro into Andrew, who'd spoken to Business Weekly, and a call as well. If you're in the gaming industry, we would really like to do a panel episode, because it's a very buoyant industry within Cambridge. And the final piece of news that I have is for anyone interested in joining this year's Impulse program at the Maxwell Centre. If you remember, we've talked about it in the past, it's a 12-week part-time hybrid program running from the end of April to mid-July. The applications have actually closed, but bizarrely, there are still some sponsored places available. So this is where the industry comes in and sponsors places. So the program's actually looking for PhD students or postdocs, and you can be at any UK higher education institute. It's not a Cambridge specific program. So if you know anyone that's in the fields of material science, engineering, biotech, biological sciences, then do, you know, point them in the direction of Impulse. And you can just go quickly Google Impulse at Maxwell Centre and you can find all the details there.
Excellent. Let's move on to some things in your diaries. So Springboard are announcing that their startup grant for this year is now open for entries. They are offering a free project worth up to £20,000 to any promising new startup developing a medical device or a life science technology product. Entries have got to be in by the 31st of May. If you want to know more and meet the Springboard team, come along to the Bradfield Centre on the 10th of April, where they'll be doing a pop-up between 11:30 and 2:30. A few other bits and pieces. The marketing meetup, which we mentioned last week, is on the 4th of April, and they're looking at AI for this one, so that should be interesting. That's also at the Bradfield Centre. Tech educators who have their campus with us at the Bradfield, they have their graduation event to celebrate the people that are coming off their coding courses. That's on the 5th of April. And again, something we mentioned last week, on the 16th of April, Cambridge Software Crafters are giving you the opportunity to create an API to control the Mars rover, which is sounds really interesting.
That's great. And they're just events at the Bradfield Centre. So there are loads of events going on around Cambridge, but it's great to keep showcasing a few of them as they come up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you've got any, send them in. You know, I'm adding things I'm aware of, but, you know, feel free to send them in. This isn't just about Bradfield Centre events, obviously. It's open to everyone.
Absolutely. Okie dokie, so that's your news and updates. So let's move on to today's episode. I'm thrilled to welcome today's guest, Paul Beestel, who is CEO of an exciting new startup called Hooton Bio. Hooton Bio have got a rather huge objective to decarbonize an industry that moves across vast oceans for 330 days a year, uses 200 million tons of diesel fuel a year, and requires its fleet to be operational for over 30 years. So let's find out more. Hi, Paul. Thanks for coming onto the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So Hooton Bio were a 21 to Watch winner last year in 2023. And I've known you since your head days at Cambridge Consultants. But you're here today in your role specifically as CEO of Hooton Bio. So would you introduce yourself and tell us how you found yourself in this role?
Yeah. So I'm Paul Beestel, as you said. One of my many hats over the years, I've found myself as CEO of Hooton Bio, mainly because I met an amazingly inspiring guy. So about a year and a half ago, no, a bit more, 2 years ago nearly, I was introduced to a guy called Dr. John Archer, who's ex-Cambridge University, who has spent his life working on microorganisms that can be useful. And I met John for a drink, and I ended up helping him on a journey to commercialize a new biofuels company.
I was just going to say, John is an absolute legend, as you say. Is he still talking to me?
Yeah, I spoke to him this morning and I said we were doing this and he sent his apologies again. So he's still scared of you.
Excellent.
Which is probably helpful.
Excellent. That's what I like to know.
We all are. So this sounds like another Cambridge pub story of a company formation. But I understand that a lot of the development was actually done in Asia. So could you walk us through the kind of founding team?
Yeah, so there are three key founders. There's John Archer I've spoken about, Dr. Noor Aslin Mokhtar, who is Malay, mm-hmm. and was one of John's PhD students here in Cambridge. They go back 20 years, right. So they're thick as thieves, basically. And then Suhaiza Jamhor, who's also Malaysian, who was one of John's master's students. And John did, I think, 20 years at Cambridge.
Right.
And then the opportunity came up to help set up the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. John went out to do that and did that for 10 or 11 years and took some of his team with him. In Saudi Arabia, working on microorganisms that could be useful, they started thinking about oil and oil replacement because obviously the economy in Saudi Arabia rotates around oil. Mm. Having done that stint in Jeddah, John decided he actually wanted to spend a bit more time with his family who'd stayed in the UK, nominally retired, but we all know Cambridge academics never retire, came back to Cambridge. And then the three founders set up Hutan Bio in 2019 to try and commercialize biofuels and hit some problems with timing in the pandemic. Things went a bit quiet. But where we are today, the two Malaysian founders run our biology R&D center out in Malaysia. And John and I are headquartered here in the UK. We've just raised our first institutional investment, and we're now going to be building our commercial footprint and our engineering team here in Cambridge.
So let's come on to the funding and the expansion of the team in a moment. But actually, I want to kind of get an idea of the size of the problem. So you just said then about, you know, John was out in Saudi looking at oil replacements, which is very logical. So as I understand it, Hutan Bio, you've created a fuel that looks like, feels like, and behaves like diesel. So it has this huge potential to disrupt shipping, transportation industry. So how are you doing this, and what is, well, let's first of all, what's the size of the problem? You know, let's put some context on it. It's got to be huge, right?
It is. So we're focusing on heavy transport, which three sectors, aviation, shipping, and what we call heavy land transport. So that's trucks and then dumpers and things with caterpillar tracks that are painted yellow that go into mines and things. And between those three, they use about 8.7 billion barrels of oil a year. I don't really know what a barrel is, or I didn't. That's about a billion tons, just over a billion tons of oil a year. And obviously that's got a carbon footprint. And as the war in Ukraine showed, if shipping gets damaged, people starve. You know, this is not just about us getting aviation fuel to go on holiday. This is about moving goods around the planet in a way that we need to do, and we need to find a more ecological way of doing it. So yeah, it's very like diesel. It will burn in a diesel engine. It's slightly thicker. But certainly in the marine sector, it will drop straight into a ship and go fine. It's likely to be used as a blend in land transport because of regulation. Actually, putting pure biofuel in is not something the world is ready for, and it will need to be refined for sustainable aviation fuel.
So am I correct in understanding then that there's no retrofit needed on the engines? It can just drop straight into a standard diesel engine.
That is the magic. Yeah. So people talk to me and say, is this a transition technology? And it's like, yeah, it probably is, but I think I'll be dead before that transition is completed. Mm. So, you know, people are building new ships today that burn oil. Mm. Ships have an operating life of 30 to 40 years. So yeah, I think that's a unique selling point. The only efficient way to carry large amounts of energy that you need for long distance is to use hydrocarbons. So rather than trying to change that, let's change the hydrocarbon. Let's make it absorb carbon while it's growing. And then when we burn it again, we're still net zero or better.
So that kind of touches on the benefit of the emission ends of, I guess, of the scale. Talk to us about the kind of development then of the biofuel, and what does that process look like? I believe it took 10 years and you developed a floating lab, which sounds quite interesting. So talk us through that kind of development life cycle and what it takes to actually put this into production.
Yeah. Okay. So when you say you, that's John and the team. It was before I joined. And they kind of turned the problem on its head. Most people look at an organism and think, what can we do with it? John and the team decided, let's look at a problem and then let's see if we can find an organism that can fix that problem. And so the problem was we wanted an organism that would grow in salt water because many biofuels need fresh water, which drives water poverty in the developing world. And it means that we can grow in areas where we don't need to clear forested land. So our vision is we grow in deserts in photobioreactors, which is a posh word for plastic bags. So that's the vision. And to do that, what John and the team did is they took samples of tropical shallow water algae. Mm-hmm. They took over a trillion samples, which is quite a big number. That's colonies, that's not individual cells. And they put them through a stress pipeline. So they were exposed to predation, to viruses and other toxins, to high levels of salinity. And at the end of it, they had to survive and they had to produce a lipid, so an oil that was comparable with fossil fuels that we use today. Mm. And it was over 100 different species came out of the end of that pipeline. Of that, 80 of them were in the same genus, so the same family, which was previously unknown to science.
Oh, okay.
So that is what we call HBX. That is our product. And then what John and the team have done is through guided evolution is actually further improve the salinity tolerance. So what you do effectively, you increase the salinity. The organisms that flourish are the ones you then take out and use for the next generation.
So I'm going to come on to HBX in a second, but did you use technology? So you've gone from a trillion sample colonies to 80. Or was that literally 10 years of research and the work on the floating lab?
So a lot of the work was in refining that process to make it efficient. So actually the organisms we use now are ones that we have isolated in Malaysian tropical waters since the company was set up. So our current organisms were all pulled out of the Malacca Straits and the South China Sea, so local to where we're currently growing. But yeah, there's a heavily automated process that basically applies these stresses and monitors things. You can't look at a trillion samples under a microscope without an infinite number of humans. I mean, it gets down to Shakespeare and monkeys, you know, it's that, you just can't do it. So a lot of John's IP and the team's IP has been on that process to find the useful algae.
So now let's move on to the biofuel itself. How is technology used to produce that?
Fundamentally, what we're looking to build here in Cambridge is a smart agribusiness. So actually the algae grows in photobioreactors, so in these plastic bags, in salt water. But to have an impact in the oil world, this needs to grow at a scale that's pretty spectacular. And the places we're looking to deploy, which is deserts close to the sea, so we can get salt water, aren't renowned for having huge populations. So we need to actually put as much automation in as possible. So at the moment, the photobioreactors themselves need to have the appropriate shape such that as we bubble CO2 through, we optimize what they call the mass transfer, the transfer of the CO2 from the liquid actually into the algae so that it can be captured. We need to have automated control systems that control the inputs. So measure the sunlight, control how we put the CO2 through, control fertilizer, those sort of things, such that we're going to be building big industrial plants that are highly automated, that don't need microbiologists to run them because the brains of those microbiologists have been distilled into this control system that we're developing.
And these big industrial plants could ultimately be anywhere.
They need to be in areas with high levels of sunlight to be efficient. So it would grow here in the UK, but not very well. We're targeting 40 degrees north to 40 degrees south, which is basically the southern tip of Spain, pretty much as the upper end. We're targeting deserts because that's areas that aren't used for agriculture at the moment. Our biggest ethos here is that we don't stop people producing food so that we can feel good about driving our diesel cars around in a nice kind of way. And we want to be close to the sea because it's easier to pump seawater short distances than long distances. So when you look at that, and then you look at places that aren't under UN sanctions that are kind of safe to operate in, we've got six markets that we've targeted as our likely early stage. And so that's Morocco, Namibia, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Western Australia, and Northern Chile. So they're all very similar. They're scrubby desert land. The land's not really useful. So we've been talking to mining companies who get value from underneath the surface. They'd love a way of getting value from the surface of the land as well.
That's really interesting. It prompts a couple of questions. So I don't know if you'll let me ask two in a row.
Well, go for I'll it. Go I think I just
okay.
did that.
Okay. So my first question, which you'll get from, I guess, every investor you ever speak to, you talked about today, was it 1 billion tons of diesel are used by shipping and transport, except heavy transport, you said. So paint us a picture in terms of how much you need to scale to make a significant impact in that kind of switching to your biofuel. You know, how many plants are we talking, and how much manufacturing capability would you need to develop?
So the This is the terrifying bit, to be brutally honest. The scale, this is a scale up like no scale up I've ever really thought about before. Yeah. So right now we're producing oil in litres and tens of litres for testing.
Right.
So we're doing engine tests, we're doing lab tests, we're working with partners so that they basically say, yeah, this oil is usable. So this is the first technology I've ever worked with. I have no doubt there's a market. Mm-hmm. We've got to prove product market fit.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. From a scale up point of view, anything helps.
Yeah.
And, you know, our vision is we're not going to build all these plants ourselves. We're going to partner. This is an infrastructure play as a different investment model in the long term. Mm-hmm. That's the way we can drive scale quickly. Mm. But I mean, to put some numbers on it, so a square kilometer of plant produces about 35,000 barrels of oil a year, also captures 22,000 tons of CO2 a year.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, this is pretty cool stuff. Mm. But to run one of the world's biggest ships, so one of the big bulk carriers that perhaps goes from, you know, from Shanghai to Los Angeles across the Pacific, to run that for a year, we need between 5 and 10 square kilometers of growth just to run one ship.
Okay.
But, you know, these guys have fuel bills of $50 million a year.
Yeah.
So even working on one ship is better than no ships.
Yeah.
And the reason we're targeting shipping first is because actually there's a supply chain with fuel brokers who pull together fuel off the market, very keen to work with us to start it as a blend, to add in, to start bringing benefit. And fundamentally, when we get to that a few tons stage, from then on, we've got a market we can scale in. Mm. And isn't that, I mean, what a lovely problem for a startup to have. It's a, from our scale, it's an almost infinite market. You know, that's not going to be our limitation. Our ability to scale and grow the business in the right direction is the thing that worries me, not will people buy it.
Yeah. And the follow-on question, which you touched on there, actually, when you describe the kind of plant that's necessary, obviously as a green tech or an agritech startup, I'm sure that you've thought really deeply about the environmental impact of that as well. Yeah. So maybe you could talk us through that, because obviously your mind immediately jumps to like an oil refinery, which is, you know, polluting. So I'm sure that your plant and your infrastructure is also going to be incredibly kind to the environment. Is that fair?
Yep. That, I mean, absolutely, that's our ambition. So we do use plastic. Mm-hmm. The photobioreactors are plastic film. And the challenge is to make them as thin as possible to reduce the amount of plastic we use, but make them as robust as possible. So we need to have them reliable. Our target design life for those bioreactors is 3 years, at which point we'll bring them back and recycle them. Mm-hmm. So it's a plastic that can be recycled. But it's not like an oil refinery. I always say, so you know, these are lines of photobioreactors.
Actually growing things.
Growing things. They're green.
Yeah.
So think about a vineyard. It's an oil vineyard.
Yeah.
That's kind of the vision. So yeah, we need to build supporting infrastructure. You know, the footprint to build it is fairly large. Mm. But our initial calculations suggest that the carbon payback, for want of a better phrase, is within 2 or 3 years.
Right. Okay.
I love it's an oil vineyard. Yeah, that's just
me too. Great. That's one of the ones I'm proud of.
Yeah, no, that's cracking.
The rules of business and society have changed, and Mish Kondureya stands at the forefront of this change, championing the innovation ecosystem at the heart of Cambridge. Our expertise is advising innovative companies at all stages of their life cycle, from startup investment right through to exit. We advise founders, entrepreneurs, management teams, and their investors. Discover what you can do with the law of tomorrow today at mishkon.com.
Let's jump back to one of the things that you alluded to earlier on, which was funding. So earlier this year, you received your seed funding of 2.25 million, I believe.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about where that came from, who's involved in it, what the process was like.
I'm sure many of your listeners will know raising money at the moment is quite tricky. It took a long time. It took longer than we'd hoped. It went to the wire. But we closed investment with a London-based fund called Clean Growth Fund. Really interesting fund, because 20% of their fund comes from the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero. So there's a link through to UK government. We got term sheets from other VCs as well, but we thought this was the closest fit to our ethos. you know, they are totally focused on impact and climate. The lead partner on that deal, Jonathan Tudor, has joined our board, and Jonathan's an incredibly informed, connected, and helpful guy. So, you know, that bit's been brilliant. The round is still open. We've got about another £1 million that we're still in discussions with, ranging between other VCs and a couple of strategics. Again, we've got lots of interest. We're looking to close that out fairly shortly.
And was the 2.5 million your first source of funding, or did you do some pre-seeds with maybe local angels or something?
Yeah, so we did do a pre-seed round. Really interesting story. So two of our angel investors are two of the founders of CMR Surgical.
Okay.
Who found it really hard to raise money, like lots of startups do. And they actually sat down and said, we know it's really hard. We want Cambridge to be able to get businesses that can accelerate quickly and get ready to scale. So Keith Marshall and Luke Hares, who are two of the founders, gave us pretty good slug of angel investment to help us start that process and get underway. And then also one of Luke's friends, a lady called Sophie Hannah, who isn't in the tech scene, except that she was an angel investor in CMR, is now again looking to put money back into other startups. She actually writes the Hercule Poirot novels under license from the Christie family. Okay. And she's fantastic. So she's in and out of the university. She's writing things. A great sounding board for when I say, this is our pitch deck, how's the story? Actually having access to somebody who's completely different is really helpful.
And you touched on the kind of the team and the locations and, you know, the R&D element and the engineering element. Talk to us about the plan for Cambridge and, you know, how you're planning to grow the team here, what kind of job roles that you'll be creating here, and what does the talent pool look like? And, you know, is this the right area for the kinds of people that you need?
That's the easy bit, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, that was talked about at the Cambridge Tech Week launch, that actually it's not just about the university scientists, it's about that engineering community. And from when I joined, I was like, we need to build the engineering capability here in Cambridge. We've just hired our head of engineering. I can't name drop yet because he's got some exit issues to resolve, but you know, that's great news. And the plan is we're going to grow an engineering team of about 5 or 6 people, and then a couple of people in commercial roles. And because we've still got our R&D center in Malaysia, project management is going to be really key. We're running different strands that have to converge at the right time. So, you know, we're going to build a fairly standard early stage, small engineering capability. We're also working with some outsourced resource already. Face that, I've got a background in consultancy. There's some really good people working at the consultancies across Cambridge and also as sole traders. So, you know, actually, I think we've got everything that we need for that engineering development here. Long term, when we're talking about manufacturing 250,000 photobioreactors, that's not going to be local. But the design stage to get us ready for that and that transition, I absolutely believe we're in the right place.
Sounds like you've got that kind of opportunity, a little bit like Pragmatic, where you're based in Cambridge, but creating economic value in other places.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's you know, we've got a team of, I think, 9 in Malaysia. Again, Malaysian universities produce some brilliant graduates. And isn't it great that they don't have to come to Europe to get good jobs? I think that's fantastic. And long term, we are still going to have jobs on these vineyards, on these plants, because people are going to need to operate them. But actually, they're going to be higher value, higher skilled jobs, which again is something that's quite important to me.
I mean, I think that that's a really positive byproduct, if you like, of what you're doing. You know, you're going to these semi-arid places and you're going to be, you know, yes, we've got the engineering and the tech jobs and everything else, but actually you're going to be able to help those communities on the ground as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a way for the people that own that land to get some value from it, because at the moment it's just sitting there idle. And then the other bit, if I'm feeling a bit philosophical, is we also increase the photosynthetic capability of the planet because we're putting photosynthesis where it doesn't exist today. That's a way of driving carbon reduction over time.
Amazing. So what's next? You've given us a few suggestions there. You're building a team. You're still looking for funding. What do you think you're going to look back on 2024 and what's going to have happened?
So I think there's three things we're working on at the moment. One of them is proving the engineering is scalable and repeatable. So I'm not right now, like most startups, I'm not necessarily worried about cost and price in quite the same way as I need to be further down the road, but I need to believe we've got a trajectory. But actually, these automated control systems, our ambition is they will grow this stuff better than our biologists can, because they're measuring the environment every minute rather than every day. So that's part one. Part two is proving product market fit, as I talked about earlier. So actually, have we got an oil that one of the majors will put through their refinery? Because that's our path to things like aviation fuel. as far as we're aware, and we've done our own testing, we believe there's nothing in there that would cause a problem. We need customers to actually say, yep, this is spot on. And then the third thing is getting our first scale-up site. So where are we going to build that first site out of those six countries I've talked to? And we've got conversations going on in two of those countries at the moment, trying to work out where that first one goes. And that's actually an area where we're getting support from the British government, you know, talking to the embassies, those sort of things. There's a lot of interest, you know, at the political level in fixing net zero can be driven from Britain, even if the deployment isn't. So that's been really positive.
Sounds like you've got a busy year ahead. There's a lot to do there.
There is. Yeah. Isn't that always the stage? We've just closed seed funding. You relax for about 7 minutes. You have a glass of wine and then you hit the ground running. That's the job. But I think that's, you know, it's all achievable. We've got a great team in Malaysia already. I know we're going to grow a great team in Cambridge. We've started with that person to head the engineering function, who's a hire I'm really proud that we've managed to get. They're going to be able to build that team. And we're already going great guns on the deployment location. So I think none of it scares me.
Yeah.
It's a tall order, but it's all feasible.
Yeah. And achieving those milestones then unlocks the opportunity for the Series A, I assume.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then we're building something that shows we can do it at scale.
Mm.
So in some ways, you talk about pragmatic. You know, they build fabs.
Yeah.
We're going to be building vineyards.
Yeah.
We're going to be possibly on the Moroccan coast or in Amman, there in Sedgefield. You know, but it's almost that same thing. The intellectual centre is in Cambridge, but the deployment for various reasons needs to be elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It's amazing. We will be watching with great interest, and please do give John a hug from me.
I will do.
Today's show was produced by Carl Homer of Cambridge TV and supported by our media partner, Business Weekly. The Cambridge Tech Podcast is available on all major podcast platforms and on cambridgetechpodcast.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star review. It will really help others discover the show.
Winter Comfort is the day support service for people facing homelessness in Cambridge. We offer advice and support to help people restore their sense of dignity, of control, and hope. Winter Comfort helps rebuild lives. Visit wintercomfort.org.uk to find out how you can help us to help those in greatest need in our community.